Here is a little kind of break, relaxation, eating potatoes that we're roasting on a charcoal pit. And so us Westerners were, you can see what James is doing, delicately peeling the skin of the potato, which was all like charred black. We were pretty dainty about it, but then our North Korean colleagues would just bite right into it. And you can see that's the interpreter there talking to Clive, and her lips are completely black from eating the potato. I'm sure it's good for you. So, our project. After the 2011 trip, we came back and AAAS checked out what it would take to really collaborate with the North Korean scientists, not just in theory and not just talk, but actually be on the ground working with them. And we went out, we raised money for the project, we got the licensing through the Treasury Department, and this process took a full 2 years to complete for various reasons. I mean, it's hard to get funding for work in North Korea. It's deemed kind of risky, and you know, it's not easy to persuade Treasury Department to allow scientists to bring in equipment. And there were aspects of the collaboration that we couldn't do because the equipment itself was forbidden under any circumstance to bring it into North Korea. So there's a type of technique called MT, magnetotellurics, which looks at electrical conductivity below the surface. It's really great at imaging below the surface, but MT devices cannot be brought into North Korea because components could be used for missile guidance. Seismometers, on the other hand, are perfectly fine. And we were told we didn't even need a license for the seismometers, but we brought them in, and we established them in this array that's a total distance about 50 kilometers. So it's a linear array coming from PEC-2, which is the far left red dot. And this was not to measure local earthquakes. That's not the point of deploying an array like that. The point is that these seismometers all receive waves, earthquake waves, that from earthquakes that happen across the globe. So these waves travel through the earth, and they just continue to travel. And they so an earthquake in Los Angeles will be registered quite weakly, but they'll be registered here at this array. Earthquakes in Japan, wherever, will register on these seismometers. So the relative speed of the waves when they reach the seismometers, that changes, and it changes according to the composition of the rock layers beneath the volcano. So molten lava and hard rock result in different speeds of the waves. And through having six seismometers, you can get a pretty rough image of what the structure is below the volcano. And you can roughly map where all the magma is. So the team did this for 2 years, from 2013 to 2015. And they were able to get a pretty good image of the magma chamber beneath the volcano and confirm that there is quite a bit of magma down there. So in principle, it continues to be a very serious volcano that would have to be monitored very closely. Interestingly, this is not very far from the Pyongyi nuclear test site. Also, coincidentally, during those 2 years, the North Koreans did not test any nuclear weapons, so the seismometers didn't pick up any signals from the test site. Some people said, well, you must have had a deterrent effect on the nuclear program, and I don't think that's the case. I think it was a coincidence. One aspect of the collaboration that we're particularly proud of is the ability to train North Korean scientists outside North Korea, and to expose them to what life is like in other parts of the world. And here's London. So here's four members of the North Korean team who spent a month in London in the spring of 2015. So, you know, it's mostly to get them to be more productive members of the team, because they had published joint papers together. That's another facet that we're proud of. They published three peer-reviewed articles so far about various aspects of the work. And to have them not only operate the seismometers and gather the data, but to contribute to the ideas and the analysis of the information. So that's where things stand on the project now. We meaning the Mount Paektu Geoscientific Group, that's the name of the various organizations involved in this, including the UK universities, the AAAS, Pintec in Pyongyang. We are planning the next phase of the research that is expected to start up in 2019. It's going to be even more ambitious surveys of the whole volcanic region, not just Mount Paektu, more refined imaging beneath the surface of the volcano, studying the geology, the geochemistry, and so forth. So it may be a major expansion of the project that, if all goes well, will begin next summer. So the third part of my talk is about current kind of threat, which is quite serious. And my familiarity with it dates back to 2013. So MDR-TB, that's multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. And it is it's a major problem in North Korea. So in 2013, I joined a team from Stanford University and the Christian Friends for Korea, who have been helping the North Koreans to try to both treat patients with TB and also to combat, you know, the greater scourge of multi-drug resistant TB. And the project specifically that I tagged along for was the establishment of a reference laboratory that was up to World Health Organization standards to be able to take a sample from a patient, go to the lab, find exactly what strain it is and what drugs the strain would be susceptible to, and then give the right drugs to the patient. Of course, this is done outside North Korea. That's a standard approach to treating TB. You have to know which strain it is, and then you treat it appropriately. In North Korea, they didn't have that until 2013. The reason North Korea has such a problem dates to the famine in the mid-1990s. You may know, as Korea scholars, that up to 1 million North Koreans died as a result of the famine, just very poor agricultural yields in the mid-1990s. The survivors were left quite vulnerable and susceptible to infection. So tuberculosis started to really spread rapidly in these conditions. By 2000, the year 2000, North Korea realized the gravity of the situation, and the World Health Organization came in to help. So in those few years, there was really very big gaps in treatment coverage that allowed strains to proliferate. And TB is really hard to treat because patients have to take the medication every day for weeks on end, and they can't miss a day. So the standard international protocol is to monitor them closely as they're taking their treatment. That was hit and miss in North Korea for quite some time. So that led to these multi-drug resistant TB strains. This is a village south of Pyongyang in the Kaesong area, and this is a TB kind of ward. So thanks to the efforts primarily of Christian Friends of Korea, they were able to provide, you know, material support for the treatment of TB patients, both in providing medicines and giving them more adequate nutrition. some of the villagers that we met on this trip, and this was the only time in my 7 trips that I was in a North Korean village. I'd been up to beautiful Mount Paektu, which is a forested area, and there's a nice city, small city nearby, but it's not indicative of what North Korean life is like. I mean, this is more indicative of what, for most North Koreans, what they experience. It's pretty grinding poverty. But Chris and friends in Korea have helped them, especially with nutrition. So they told us, for example, that at the time, this was 2013, they would receive rations for meat, to be able to get meat from the local store, just a few times a year on the important national holidays. So the rest of the year, their protein was mainly through soybeans. This is a Ministry of Health official gathering sputum samples from villagers. And this is what the village looked like. I mean, you don't see much vegetation there. And I mean, the landscape has been stripped pretty bare. The roofs of these village homes are damaged, and they were damaged a few years before that by a typhoon, and they just didn't have the money to repair the tiles on the buildings. These three little boys are watching us curiously. We were there looking up from the TB rest house. Here's another view of the TB rest house, and this is how they were heating the room. So there's a side of a hill with shale, and they were just digging out the shale, and they would dump it next to the rooms, and there's a little entrance to shovel in the shale to these very primitive type of coal stoves. In Pyongyang itself, they had a TB ward for children. So this was also March 2013, so 5 years before my last trip. And here's some of the kids getting some fresh air. But inside the ward, this was a radiogram they were using to basically x-ray the children's lungs. And this is a 1950s, I think, East German machine. And it wasn't clear. I could never get it straight whether they didn't have x-ray film because it was no longer made for this kind of machine or because they couldn't afford it. It wasn't clear to me. I asked several times in different ways. I never got clarity, but they were very clear. They didn't have any x-ray film. So the doctors would actually stand there during the x-ray and observe the x-ray live. And they told me that because of the exposure to x-rays, the doctors often get cataracts. So they have to have cataract surgery like every several years because of their exposure to x-rays. So it's pretty horrific conditions. In contrast, this is a Stanford University researcher in the new reference laboratory. It was new at the time. So there was, you know, kind of a hopeful situation then that North Korea was going to turn the corner. However, on my most recent trip this past March, I ran into a team from Christian Friends of Korea who were also there at the time, staying at the same hotel. And they told me that, in fact, in the 5 years since I was with them on the trip, the rate of tuberculosis in North Korea has approximately doubled. So it's already quite high, and it's doubled. So it is a big, big priority. I know that Christian Friends of Korea and others have been lobbying quite hard for support for increasing TB drug supplies going to North Korea, experts going in to try to get a handle on this. And it's not simply for the sake of North Korean people. This is a regional problem. TB could easily spread into China through people who defect or just travelers and Chinese tourists coming in.
Is it contagious?
It is, yeah. In fact, statistically, 1 in 3 people in the world have TB, but for the most part, it's an inactive, latent infection that, you know, your body can easily suppress. That's globally, this figure. I don't know what the figure is for the U.S.
But in this country, do we get vaccinated? Is there a vaccine or a shot? No. Isn't that the thing when they rub your skin to test whether or not you have it?
Well, they test whether you have it, yeah.
But there's no.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's certainly no vaccine, but how to steel yourself against TB. Normally, healthy people are fine. But when you're immune compromised or your body's under severe stress, which a lot of North Koreans are, just because of the environment that they live in. Okay, so I think that was my last slide. So thank you very much. I think I've left plenty of time for Q&A, and we'd be happy to interact with you all. Thank you.
Well, that was really stunning. I guess what brings home to me is the message is that, one gets a sense, that having scientific or any academic engagement with North Korea would be a one-way process, that we would be giving them information. But this is a wonderful case of how, knowledge was produced together and was of value to scientists worldwide, not just the other way around. How do you continue to make that case to the broader scientific population that there's stuff to learn from the DPRK?
Yeah, well, I think the PEC-2 project in particular is special for that reason. I mean, this is a scientific question that appeals to Western scientists. Mm-hmm. And so it's a area that you can justify not just for the sake of science diplomacy, mm-hmm. but for real scientific engagement and cooperation. Mm-hmm. It's hard to identify projects that have that, inherent appeal to outside scientists. Certainly, it's harder to make that case for ecological restoration, where it's mm-hmm. a matter of going in and helping, advise them on mm-hmm. what to plant or how to restore a watershed or so forth. It's much more of an applied scientific mm-hmm. activity that's worthy in its own right, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have that that basic level of scientific curiosity that a project like PEC-2 has. So we're always on the lookout for, projects that do have that appeal. Other countries like Iran, we had identified a number of projects that mm-hmm. that really would be a great fit for scientists to work together, but because of the current situation, we're kind of stymied in that. So we're taking another closer look at North Korea.
I see. Thank you. Questions? The floor is yours. Sir?
What proportion of the North Korean budget is devoted to scientific research? I see two areas where they excel, nuclear and missile technology, and also in hacking. They're supposed to be very good in that. So can you just give figures as to 1% of the budget goes into scientific research, or 3, 4, or 5?
I think there's probably official figures available, and I think it's on the order of 1%, but it doesn't have much meaning.
Yeah.
It doesn't have much meaning because they don't clarify what that 1% is actually spent on. So it's, the nuclear establishment is well-funded, but is that scientific funding? It doesn't appear to be the case. I think it's a separate kind of budget line. It doesn't go through the academy. Most of the science spending goes through the academy, and a little bit goes through various agencies like the Korea Earthquake Bureau. But the fact is, on the ground, most scientists receive little to no funding. So any cooperation that's done with the North Koreans, the burden of paying for it falls on the Western partners.
In hacking, they're just exceptional because, as I remember, they stole $80 million from Bangladeshi Bank.
Yeah, that's That's certainly true. And again, is that scientific spending? Is that certainly part of their military spending? These are military hackers, but I would say that it is a scientific technical capacity which they have.
Two questions. One is there any seismic consequence to the North's nuclear testing? And secondly, do you know why they don't have portraits of Kim Jong-un all over the place in the way they do his father and grandfather?
So, seismic consequence, you mean to the local environment, or?
I'm just wondering if there's any relationship between nuclear testing and disturbing the geography such that it has some kind of effect on volcanic activity.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. So the test site is not far from PEC-2, but the magnitude of the tests are not nearly sufficient to trigger a volcanic eruption. I know the South Korean press has batted that around as a possibility, but all kind of analysis I've seen suggests that it's just simply, you know, a couple orders of magnitude less than what you would need, like 100 to 1,000 times less powerful. It certainly does have it's felt in the region. In China, when they had their last nuclear test, people, you know, felt the shockwave and windows rattled and so forth in Chinese towns across the border. And the latest test, it seems to have collapsed the main tunnel at the Pyongyi test site. So it did make further testing more complicated, which made it a little bit easier for their gesture to close the test site, as it would have been hard to do the next test. Why Kim Jong-un's image is not out on the street, I don't know. I mean, there's probably North Korean analysts here who are much better suited to answer that question, and if anyone wants to chime in, please do. I mean, what I've been told is that the regime feels that it's better for the population to kind of revere the older generations for now. Kim Jong-un, as powerful as he is and having consolidated power, there's either a feeling that he doesn't want to assert himself in that way, to have that image out there, or he simply feels it's not necessary. But any Korean watchers, please chime in.
Jisoo?
Thanks for sharing your interesting project. I've learned a lot. So it seems like you've been interacting with North Korea for a little more than a decade now. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious as to know whether you've noticed some, like over the years, some of the changes that, especially with your recent trip, there are changes to open the society, or especially also in terms of, I guess your area is science, so in terms of science technology, if you've noticed any kind of changes in North Korea in terms of trying to open up, and also whether you've noticed advancement in their technology over the years. So I'm just curious to know more of the changes that you've noticed over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certainly there are superficial changes that are very kind of easy to make. For example, my first trip in 2004, when I stayed at the Koryo Hotel, which is right in the heart of the downtown, and at 10 p.m. at night, I look out the window and the city was completely dark. Aside from this little tiny section of town where the elite lived and where the foreigners were staying, the rest of the city was just, it was lights out. All across the city. Now you look at the Pyongyang skyline at night, even late at night, there's a lot of light. I mean, it feels in that respect more like a modern city. They have taxis now. They didn't have taxi service in 2004. Foreigners still, I mean, at least Caucasian foreigners can't hail a cab. They won't pick you up. But at least for local Pyongyang citizens, they have that option. In terms of scientific development, I mean, they are better equipped, the scientists, than they have been in the past. They have a lot more computer technology than they had in 2004. In 2004, the Academy showed me their intranet. So they had this intranet system that unites all the academic institutions, and they upload information that's been carefully vetted, and people had access to it. It was pretty slick, kind of Yahoo-style homepage in 2004. So they had that back then. But I've seen a lot more well-equipped computer laboratories, a lot more better-equipped libraries. So in 2004, I visited the Academy's University of Sciences, which is in the southern part of the city, and they had a library, and we visited the library, and I asked them to show me some of their scientific journals. And the librarian disappeared into the back, and she brought out these 1980s Soviet photocopies of journals. These were 20 years old, and they were like, she brought them out like holy relics, like, here's what we had. So things have improved a lot in terms of scientific literature. I think they made a really concerted effort at their embassy postings to gather scientific information, either printed or on thumb drives, and bring it back. But for the most part, it's still kind of vetted and uploaded to their intranet. So they still are very careful with how knowledge is shared. Other than that, it's hard to tell whether there's much scientific advancement. I mean, I get the feeling most scientists don't do much of anything. They don't have money to do anything except perhaps teach. So it's not a whole lot of research going on that's not done in conjunction with outsiders, or it's strategic, nuclear or cyber, whatever. The only other comment I would make is that this past trip, the mood on the streets was just so enthusiastic. I mean, there was, people were just in a great mood. Well, it was spring, first of all, early spring. It was finally starting to get warm. But it was Kim Jong-un's visit to Beijing. And I contrasted that with my trip in March 2013 when it was a siege mentality, because the military exercises, South Korea, U.S., were going on. And so the propaganda was such that we were about to be attacked. And so buses had camouflage netting on it. This is right in the heart of the city. So people were like, okay, we're ready in case there's an attack. It was much different atmosphere.
But is that, I mean, do you see that kind of development beyond Pyongyang? Or because we talk about that, you know, a lot inside Pyongyang. Yes, there, you know, it's been really developing, and it's becoming a modern city. But the question is, I mean, is that really spreading throughout, or is it just Pyongyang?
Yeah, that's a great question. Personally, I don't know. I think it'd be worth asking the humanitarian groups, which are the only ones who've really gotten outside Pyongyang. I haven't been outside Pyongyang since 2013, so 5 years ago. But Christian Friends of Korea, when I ran into them in March, they had just come back from a trip out into the villages. So they know what it's like on the ground. But there is more tourism to secondary cities like Wonsan now. But whether that reflects just taking people out to the beach, or whether the city itself has become a bit more vibrant, I can't say.
Esther?
Hi, Rich.
Hi, Esther.
Great to hear your talk.
Thanks.
I wonder, you touched a little bit about your travels with Treasury. I was hoping you could speak a little bit about the current environment and the challenges that you face, and perhaps share a little bit about why you work with UK scientists, and also talk a little bit about your future hopes for science diplomacy between the United States and North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in 2011, it was interesting. So I was based in Beijing at the time. And PENTAC actually reached out to me through their kind of partner in Beijing, who they've done a lot of work with, and she contacted me and said, do you know any volcanologists? North Koreans want to cooperate. And I just happened to know the guys in the UK. And I knew that they were pretty intrepid guys. I mean, they'll go any place. and they were quite eager to engage with North Koreans. So I never saw it as naturally a U.S. engagement. That had to be a U.S. engagement. I just wanted to get people who I knew were good. And but then it turned out that Clive Oppenheimer, the volcanologist, had a U.S. graduate student in his lab. And when we sought funding, the funders liked the idea of a U.S. participation on the scientific level. So we then kind of expanded the circle a bit, brought in a couple U.S. scientists as well. And North Koreans were comfortable with that. We've run into situations in the past where they really discourage us from trying to connect them with U.S. researchers. This was a few years ago. Now, I think that's probably going to change, if, you know, the path that we're on now. Regarding Treasury, it's time consuming. And it was one factor why it took a couple of years to get the project off the ground. Initially, none of us had gotten a license from Treasury Department, from OFAC before. So it was all new to us, and we needed a lot of kind of advice about how to go about doing it. But and then we encountered some hitches about certain equipment that could not be brought in, and that entailed revising the proposal a bit. But in the end, we got pretty good green light from Treasury Department to go ahead with the project. We got support from the Lansbury Foundation, which has been, generally speaking, quite supportive of engaging difficult countries. They've supported AAAS in the past on Iran and Cuba and so forth. So they've been a reliable partner in that way. Now, how things are going to change, that's a big question. I think there's this anticipation that as a result of the summit, there's going to be a more favorable environment toward working with North Korea on science engagement. That's the understanding, I guess, from conversations people have had with state. Now, how that will play out in getting OFAC licenses and whether the travel ban is going to be relaxed, that's all, I think, going to play out in the next several weeks.
Yes, thank you.
You mentioned that many of the scientists have been to regional conferences in Beijing. And I was just curious as to what kind of, is there systematic scientific engagement from the Chinese government, from Chinese scientists, or what is that collaboration relationship look like?
Yeah, there is less collaboration than you might think between China and North Korea. So China has hosted some regional meetings. Like there's a regional meeting for Northeast Asia on natural disaster risk reduction. And North Korea has been invited to these meetings. And so that's a forum where they can interact with Chinese, even with South Koreans, who go to these meetings. There has not been a lot of joint research between China and North Korea that I'm aware of. Surprisingly, there's been no on-the-ground research at Mount Paektu together, even though they share the volcano. When I was there in March, the Kim Il-sung University people talked about a project that they had with the Chinese to investigate wetlands, trans-border wetlands, and they had a joint research field work this past summer that the Chinese paid for. That's pretty exceptional. Many years ago, I had asked the Academy, the Chinese Academy of Sciences, whether they would be interested in working with AAAS to try to promote science engagement, and they were really not interested. They had they were committed to these higher level discussions between the Academy officials of both countries that didn't seem to result in much joint research, and it seemed that there was really very little appetite for it on both sides. The Chinese weren't that interested, and the North Koreans, either reflecting the Chinese attitude or maybe genuinely uninterested themselves in working closely with the Chinese. That was surprising to me, and maybe that will change. Certainly with Mount Paektu, the British PIs are, had been talking to the Chinese Earthquake Administration, which has a station at Chenbaishan, the Pekdu side, or the Chinese side of Pekdu, about, you know, full observation campaign around the entire mountain, around the entire volcano. And so there's some interest in doing that. So hopefully the British themselves can catalyze something.
Yes.
Hi, thank you for the talk. Do you see any future opportunities for collaboration on MDR-TB or health in general?
Well, yeah, I think it's pretty urgent. I know that Christian Friends of Korea is still continuing their work, but as far as I know, there was some problem with the Global Fund, and I'm not quite sure why. Maybe other people here know, but this was all coming to a head this summer, what was going to happen with TB medications getting into North Korea. That's why I flag it as a pretty urgent issue. I don't know how that has developed, whether there's been any change in the Global Fund stance. We haven't heard of that. Yeah, so it could become a crisis. I mean, that's the bulk of the TB medicines are coming in through Global Fund. Some come in through Eugene Bell Foundation, and some come in through Christian Friends of Korea. But the access of the two Western groups, the aid groups, is limited, geographically limited, constrained to pretty small parts of the country. So the bulk of the TB patients are cared for by the North Korean government through Global Fund medications, as far as I know. So it's a serious situation. Have you heard more about that, Esther?
The latest I've heard is actually Global Fund has agreed that the treatment, the patients who are currently undergoing treatment under Global Fund will continue, but they will not engage on new treatment.
Yeah.
But their decision on funding has not changed, but they will continue to see through the treatment that they've started.
Yeah. So I think it's a pretty area that's ripe for greatly increased cooperation, hopefully, in the wake of the summit. People are talking about that.
Any other comments or questions? Okay. In that event, please join me in thanking Richard Stone for an outstanding presentation.
Thank you.
And I think it's
very much.
And thank you all for coming. I appreciate also the sponsorship of the Seeger Center for Asian Studies and the GW Institute for Korean Studies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm glad we had such a good turnout, especially midsummer.
Midsummer. There's no one else around at the university.
I know. Everybody came today. That's good.
Yeah.
Nothing better than
that.
Hey Tim, how you doing? How are things in Arlington?